he was done wrong. It was not his fault. And I had witnesses who are like, oh yeah, he totally got cut off. I pull up to the scene. He's kind of helped direct traffic. It's that same attitude he had on the baseball field. He's checking on everybody else. He had every right to be throwing his batting helmet in this ice plant alongside the freeway and being all pissed off because he got cut off, and it wasn't even his trailer. He was helping a friend out. So he's got a lot on his plate, but what's he doing? He's checking on other people.
San Diego 911 emergency. You need to come right away. There's a man with a gun and it's loaded.
What is
receiving emergency signal from
4-4-11-41. We've got a white team over there. We need paramedics
close. All available units will code that way.
Welcome to the De-Escalation Conversations podcast. With me today is a really cool guy. You're going to enjoy hearing from him. His name is Jason Kerwin. He's a PhD and he's co-founder and chief executive officer of DeServo, spelled D-E-C-E-R-V-O. And you're like, Kerry, what the heck is DeServo? Well, it's a neurotech company. And you know I geek out on neuroscience. It's a neurotech company that specializes in high-speed decision-making. Think about that for just a moment. Don't take long because it's high-speed. Since its founding over a decade ago, DeServo's work, it's been featured in both popular and scientific press. Organizations like the Wall Street Journal, Scientific American, the New York Times. We won't hold the New York Times against them either. While its user base started in sports, it spread through the NCAA Division I and Major League Baseball, as well as the National Hockey League. Now, Jason, he's been faculty in academia as a research assistant professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at the State University of New York Downstate Medical Center. Prior to that faculty appointment, he completed his postdoctoral training at Columbia University. Yes, the Columbia University. And he did it under the direction of the brain-computer interface expert, Professor Paul Seda. He got his PhD in 2010, his master's in 2006 in aerospace engineering. Yes, folks, Jason is a freaking rocket scientist. And he's still a down-to-earth guy. That's the pretty cool part. So Georgia Institute of Technology, if you've ever heard of it, well, that's where he got his aerospace engineering from. He also holds a bachelor's in physics from the University of Chicago. He's also, and this is the cool thing about him, he's an active composer, a performer, and a DJ. Told you he was a cool guy in the music industry, both in New York and Pennsylvania. Today, we're going to be talking about DeServo. We're going to be talking about neuroscience because that's what we do. And we're going to be talking about high speed decision making, which as a first responder, as a K-12 school teacher, you need to be making fast decisions. Jason's going to be talking about what they do for both research and helping people make rapid, time critical, and correct decisions. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Gary. That was a great introduction. Sorry about the New York Times part.
Yeah, you know, it's okay. Like I said, we won't hold that against you. So tell us about DeServo. How did it start? What is it? You know, well, let me back off of even that. Tell me first, why should I even care about DeServo? Why should I care about Jason?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Well, you know, when we started DeServo about, like you said, over 10 years ago, from work we were doing on high speed decision making, and I came to neuroscience to biomedical engineering totally fresh. Like, I mean, it sounds similar coming from aerospace engineering into biomedical engineering. It's like, well, it's engineering. Well, it's words I don't really, you know, hear every day. But the thing with coming in from a different discipline, coming from aerospace into neuroscience engineering, biomedical engineering, was that I could look at it from a kind of a novice perspective and say, who cares, right? And why are we measuring that? right? Why are we doing this experiment? And so as I started asking those questions when I had newly joined the lab, I was kind of increasingly drawn towards what are the everyday high-speed decisions that we make in our lives. And they can be pretty mundane. You're driving down the road. I live in a rural area. You're driving down the road and there's a deer that's about to jump out in front of the road there. Or if it does, you got to slam on your brakes, right? So that's a high-speed decision. You know, you see it, you slam on the brakes, you try to stop in time. That's thinking fast, in the words of Daniel Kahneman. Thinking slow is a different version of making decisions. That's something like, do I want to buy a house in this neighborhood or that neighborhood? Do I want to buy this car or that car? Do I want to marry this person or not marry this person? Like, those are big decisions, but they're not, most of them are in high speed. Some people get married, I guess, quickly, but.
And Britney Spears.
Or Britney Spears, right. Okay. So she was breaking the ice, breaking the mold on that one. But for the most part, those are thought out, deliberate decisions that take time. High speed decisions, slam on the brakes when you're driving the car. The area we got into was, what do baseball hitters do when a pitch is coming towards them? And they have to recognize in less than a half a second whether the pitch is a curveball or a fastball, or in the words of Bobby Valentine, the manager, or if the ball is going to kill them. They got to figure all that out in, like, you know, a half a second. So those are the kind of reasons why it's important to care about high-speed decisions. They happen every day in all sorts of facets of our lives, and we were looking at how that works on a brain level.
And that's so cool. And I'll say this. I remember, because as a cop, I loved working overtime at, like, Padres games. And at the time, Padres weren't doing real well. And so the crowds were low. It was easy work, but it was fun. And sometimes we'd be right at the dugout. Sometimes we're up in the crowd. Sometimes we're more on the field. And I remember this one time it was the very first time I ever worked a dugout. And it was for the visiting team. And it was a guy who later, his brother was on the Padres. So they're competing against each other, right? It's the first time they played major league ball against each other. Later on, he ended up, one of the brothers came over, and both brothers were playing on the Padres, which was pretty cool. But this particular game, I'm working the dugout. He struck out, and I'm drawing a blank on his name. He's a really cool guy. He struck out, and everybody else who struck out came in to the dugout, and they throw their batting helmet. They were like little kids. I remember sitting there through the first couple of innings going, what a bunch of immature little shits.
I have a secret for you. They haven't gotten much better.
But I was thinking, what's up with these guys? They actually struck out. Yeah, I know it's like major big deal, and because it's the major leagues, and yet not this one player. He came into the dugout and he immediately, and this is one of the things why I say he's a really cool guy. This was my first impression of him, because I didn't know him from Adam. He started coaching the guys in the dugout. He goes, hey, he started talking about the stitching on the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And how when the pitcher was throwing it a certain pitch, I remember him saying when he's throwing his breaker, and he described how the threads were turning. I'm like, whoa, that is so cool. And it was cool for two reasons. Number one, he's picking up on that. Number two, he's not throwing his batting helmet out of anger and just, you know, ripping off his batting gloves. He's like, hey guys, when you get up there, look for this, and it's going to be this. And when he's doing this, it's that.
Right.
He had analyzed it and he was sharing it with the other players so that they could perform better. Now, in my mind, that's a good man. Number two, that's an observant guy to be looking at how the stitches are. So it's, when you were describing about baseball, I was like, oh yeah. I remember. Yeah. I'm gonna put his name. I'm gonna do some research. I'm gonna find his name. I'm gonna put it in the show notes so you guys know who I'm talking about, because this guy deserves to be honored for his approach. And what was funny was this: when he finished his baseball career, just a little 10-second side note. I was rolling down the 163 in San Diego toward downtown, and there was a crash on the freeway. happened like just before he got there. Like the wheels are still spinning on the trailer that's upside down. This guy was towing a trailer. His baseball player is now retired. He's towing a trailer and somebody cut him off and he swerved and the trailer flipped over.
Wow.
He was done wrong. It was not his fault. And I had witnesses who are like, oh yeah, he totally got cut off. I pull up to the scene. He's kind of helped direct traffic. It's that same attitude he had on the baseball field. He's checking on everybody else. He had every right to be throwing his batting helmet in this ice plant alongside the freeway and being all pissed off because he got cut off. And it wasn't even his trailer. He was helping a friend out. So he's got a lot on his plate, but what's he doing? He's checking on other people. So anyway, I'll put his name in the show notes. Keep going about DeServo. So you help baseball players take this half second that they have to decide. And what do they do with this?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Well, you know, it's funny that you worked in San Diego at the Pods games, because actually one of the first conferences I went to in this area, when I started working at Columbia, I was working on a DARPA project. DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and they're like there's a lot of R&D that goes in to the Department of Defense, but they're like an agency that specializes in R&D, and they have this like fast innovation type model. Anyway, but the first conference I ever went to was held at the Petco ballpark hotel right there that's attached. And I remember they have like all this cool memorabilia across the hotel and the view right into the stadium. It was November, so there were no games going on. But I remember thinking like, this is pretty cool. And it might have even had like a subtle impact at some point on the course of our research, because it hadn't yet gotten into baseball at that point. And it was maybe about over the next 6 months or so. I actually started leveraging my background in music first to do some experiments in neuroscience in terms of how fast decision making works and stuff like that. And you can kind of see part of my piano behind me here. But I use that as kind of the entree to figure out, get a little handle on what neurophysiological tools existed at the time and what the data processing was like.
Oh brother. I got to time you out on that one. I am just a dumb street cop.
Have you ever had an EKG? Have you ever had an EKG, Kerry?
Yeah. Okay. Unfortunately, but yeah. Okay.
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, it's a good way of explaining this concept, because when the EKG monitors your heart rate, you know, the character of your heartbeat, it's picking up a series of electrical signals that are happening in your heart. And that tells the cardiologist some kind of nature of how your heart's doing. Similar technology is called EEG. So instead of EKG, it's EEG. And EEG is a way of measuring brain activity, similar kind of way, the electrical activity of brain activity. And so that's one type of neurophysiological measurement. Another type of neurophysiological measurement, have you ever had an MRI?
I have. Again, all of these are unfortunate, but I've had them all. So I know
it. It's fortunate for us, because it means you know what I'm talking about. It means you are just as much of an expert in neurophysiology, and we're going to figure that out right now. And it is because an MRI, what did you have it on? Your shoulder, your knee, something like that? Head?
MRI, my head. Okay. My shoulder.
Uh-huh.
I think my back.
Okay. That's good.
For 30 years. I was in like a fight or two in my career. So.
Well, when they did do one on your head, actually, that's a neurophysiological measurement. Because what they're doing there in that scan of your noggin there, what they're doing is they're looking at there are different types of MRI scans. There's one's called the structural scan. It shows you basically like where everything is, right? Then there's another kind of scan they can do called a functional scan. Functional scan is one that will tell you where the blood flow is going based on, and when you're doing an experiment, you can tell people to do something versus another task or something like that. And the idea is you're trying to get them to use different parts of their brain, and you would be able to see that blood flow, relative blood flow change, indicating that those cells are being used versus these cells, right? So those are all neurophysiological measurements.
And this is great the way you explain it, because we talk about the functional MRIs all the time for determining whether somebody's in executive state or survival state, what triggers the whole Lieberman study in 2007 that started that whole thing, the basis of what we teach at IDEA right now for advanced de-escalation is exactly what you're talking about with the functional MRI machines, where the research came from. So our listeners have heard me talk about this a lot. What you're telling them just dovetails nicely into what they've already heard they're learning about as students.
That's good. Yeah. No, and actually, after we met and before doing this, I also listened to a couple of your podcasts that focused on that topic, or, you know, on neuroscientific topics. So I think it's great that the audience is aware of these things.
So you're a stalker.
I'm semi a stalker.
Okay. That's all right. I encourage that.
So that's really kind of, you know, where things began. But since I was just as novice with EEG, MRI, you know, this whole alphabet soup of ways of measuring the brain, I knew just as little about it as you did 10 seconds ago, right? But now you're almost an expert too. And so
I play now, one on TV.
Yeah, so there you go. You play it great. So that was that's the catch me if you can character. You know, he learned to be a doctor by watching.
Oh my God.
I concur. anyway, so it was a process for me to figure out and learn these, you know, ways of measuring the brain. I mean, keep in mind, I'd been doing the previous 5 years or so of aircraft design, spaceship design, you know, rocket design, like all this other kind of stuff, entry vehicle landing design, all this kind of stuff, which is totally different than how the brain and nervous system function. So
about
when
as different as you can get, holy mackerel.
So when I made this switch, I needed to like have some kind of firm footing of an area that I knew about already to kind of give me a way of figuring out and learning more about these ways that the brain is measured. And so because I had such a background in music, I used my background in music to kind of start figuring out, all right, what is it about listening to music that can tell us something about high-speed decision-making and particularly even playing an instrument? And so that's really where our first experiments began. It was all about how lay people, so non-musicians, would hear music, hear like a mistake actually in music that we programmed into the recording, and then how that mistake would register on a brain level, and then how that mistake would register on a brain level for the non-musicians versus like someone who played that instrument that they were listening to. And so, you know, if you think about like someone who's become really proficient at firearms, to make it a law enforcement analogy, someone who's really proficient with firearms, like a marksman kind of level, they're kind of like their weapon kind of becomes an extension of their own body, right? You hear this with tennis players talking about their racket, you know, but you know, there are many other areas of expertise, and that's the same way with musicians. Their instrument becomes like an extension of their body. And we were able to actually measure that effect on the brain level using this neurophysiological measurement, the EEG mostly, in musicians. And that gave us kind of the gateway to figure out like, how could this work in sports? How could this work in other areas like law enforcement, right? So baseball hitters, softball hitters, hockey officials in the NHL. We've been training the NHL, the new NHL officials for the last 6 years now with the NHL. And then, you know, moving into law enforcement has been a really interesting, you know, shift, because you're arbitrating, right? Just like you do as you're arbiting as you would as an official, as a referee, as a linesman in hockey, but you're applying a very kind of layered and complex set of policies, right? So constitutional, state law, you know, municipal law, to a particular set of situations. And so that's really kind of the shift that we made as we got into developing eTrain as our law enforcement training product. But it's got these, all that neurophysiological background, all that stuff about how to make hitters see the ball better in that split second that they have. It all has the analog to the quick decision-making that you have in a vehicle stop, or that you have in a pedestrian stop, or, you know, where you're looking for kinesic interview type, you know, cues from the person you're speaking to. All those are quick decisions. And it's just a question of how you measure it, how you show it to somebody in order to get them to try to make those decisions, and then evaluate them in a helpful way. Because I know evaluate is kind of a bad word in policing, but evaluate them in a helpful way so that it's not like, hey, my boss is going to be on me about this, but it's more like, I need to do this video next because my kinesic interviewing skills are 5 out of 10 and I need to get them up to, like, you know, the next level, right? And that helps us then use our algorithm to pick what's the next video you got to see to get from 5 to 7 or 5 to 8 or whatever it is. So that's kind of in a nutshell then how what we did in DeServo, the background of DeServo from, you know, these music experiments, baseball experiments, then transition into other areas, in particular to law enforcement.
I have a somewhat random question. And this question popped into my head immediately as soon as you started talking about the musician who plays a note that's incorrect. And you've deliberately set that up, but the listener doesn't know that.
They hear it. Yeah, they hear it.
They hear it. Yeah, hear yeah. They hear the mistake, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done anything with testing or research where an officer is maybe perhaps viewing a video, or they're with a suspect, and the suspect does something that would fall under the category of a red flag for officer safety? Maybe it's how they're standing, how they're looking, how they're glancing around, all the standard pre-attack warning indicators. Mm-hmm. And we've documented well over 20 pre-attack warning indicators. Have you done any research where an officer is seeing one of these indicators and where it triggers in their brain? Because that's one of the most difficult things for an officer to articulate is, well, I put him in handcuffs for my safety. Well, what exactly happened? Well, you know, I just had a hunch. It's not a hunch. It's right. It's you just can't articulate what of these right. factors that you cannot articulate the red flag that you saw, but you knew it was there.
Yeah.
The hair was standing up on the back of your neck for some reason.
That's right.
So have you guys done anything with that?
Yeah. I mean, not at a neuroimaging, so a neurophysiological measurement level, but, and that's mostly a funding constraint kind of thing, but it's possible to do. It's really just it's a money and a resources, like time resources, kind of issue, but we get a very good analog to that, when we measure, reaction time, so response time to something happening in a scene in eTrain. So I have a few you know, examples of that popped into my mind when you were talking about it, because, you know, in policing is at this strange interface between fast and slow decisions, right? Because you're supposed to make the decisions. You have to make them fast. In a lot, you know, in pretty much most instances, right? But you're incentivized to make them correctly, meaning slowly, right? And in particular, they have to be, you know, report writing is a big thing because that's the basis of evidence that then goes into prosecution, right? And so, you know, there's that articulation need for the next step, right? Colloquially speaking, for Law and Order in terms of the TV show. Right. So, you know, in terms of like how the law is applied, right? And in the order piece, it's how do you elucidate what happened and what you saw and what you did in response to what you saw, heard, et cetera. And We'll have examples. So in E-Train, it's all body-worn camera footage based. So when you're watching a body-worn camera of an encounter on the evening news, they don't like, you know, stop it and go, okay, should you do A, B, C, or D here, right? Or they won't like show it to you and say like, you know, tap on the screen where something weird is going on in terms of the body language of the guy who's being shown, right? They just fast forward to the bloody shootout, which gets the most clickbait. But there's a ton of relevant information going on in those interactions that's captured with the body cam and for training purposes. And those types of cues from a person you're speaking to were really the basis of how we even named E-Train what it is, E-Train, because the Anchorage Police Department had this interest in recognizing cues of escalation or de-escalation, as they called it, in the person that they're interviewing. And they were a dash cam only agency at the time. And so we were getting these dash cam videos from them, and we made this starting kind of project, you know, video game in the beginning is kind of what it was, where they would tap once on the screen if it was an escalation sign, or twice on the screen if it was de-escalation. So an escalation sign would be like, you've stopped two guys on bikes in the middle of the night because they had a report of a robbery, right? So you stop them on bikes, you're talking to them, and you know, you have a suspicion that they're the ones, but you know, you don't really know yet. And you're speaking to them, and you know, it's only visual you see. You don't see audio because it's the dashboard camera. And so you have to tap when you see a sign of escalation. So you're talking to the suspect, and the suspect then starts looking around, right? Okay, that might be a cue. He's looking for an escape route. Tap, right? Keep talking a little bit more. Now he's like grabbing onto his handlebars, right, of his bike, right? Turning them a little bit as he's kind of, you know, being talked to a little bit more. Tap, right? Anyway, so things accelerate in this interaction. He doesn't want it, you know, they decide to put him under arrest. He's resisting. Tap, right? After he's under arrest, his buddy is still on his bike, like standing on the, you know, on the crossbar there. You know, he just saw that his, you know, his friend got taken down and he's in cuffs now. And you see, you know, and then you see the officer point to him and go, you know, down on the ground. He gets off the bike, double tap, de-escalation. He gets down on the ground on his knees, double tap again, sign of de-escalation. And so, you know, you go one by one as this scene is unfolding. And with each of the officers that are doing this scenario on E-Train, it was called escalation training, E-Train at the time. You know, you could grade what timing they saw, what evidence they were looking at on the screen at that moment. And, you know, based on where they were tapping on the screen, you could tell like a distance from where they were on the screen to where the guy was actually like kneeling down, or where the guy was, you know, grabbing the handlebars. And that would tell us that they were attending to the thing that was telling them escalation or de-escalation. And so that kind of concept really then fed forward later on into all the other areas that E-Train has been used in now. And, you know, it's a whole story about like, being introduced to someone at the NYPD in New York, which is where we were before, and then wanting to kind of morph this into how they retaught the stop and frisk program after the consent decree. And so that's kind of a whole other story. But the basic underpinning of your question about, like, you know, how do officers, you know, elucidate that, hey, I just felt funny or whatever. It's because there's something going on in the scene and they're tapping for it or whatever. In the case of E-Train, they're tapping for it. And that's telling us the evidence that they're going off of, right? They can't do that in real life, right? But we can kind of get a sense of how well they're integrating visual and auditory information from how they're doing in these types of scenarios like we do in E-Train.
So how long does it take to go through E-Train? And do you only go through it once? Do you go through it once a day for the rest of your life? I mean, how does E-Train work in the ideal situation?
The use cases that I've seen mostly break down into two categories in law enforcement. There's the academy version of usage, and then there's the in-service usage. Actually, yesterday I was speaking to somebody who may have introduced me to a third category that I have heard about. I've talked to a few people about in the past. He's written a book. His name is Steve Sheridan. He's written a book on community policing and things, a couple books on leadership and things like that in policing. So shout out to Steve. Another area about like, how do you educate the community you serve in terms of like what those decisions are really like and the amount of time that you have to make them. But we haven't yet done that. We mostly have been in service training and academy training. So in service is the most like, I'd say, regular usage. But it's usually at roll call is kind of what we've seen, because you need to have kind of like a marker in the day for when it's done. Usually in the in-service training kind of world, they'll do a new scenario like maybe once a week, twice a week, three times. It really just depends what the training or what the sergeant, what the lieutenant wants to do. But it's I've noticed for the in-service usage that even though the agencies will have the service for the, you know, an entire year, they'll kind of like concentrate usage of E-Train into certain months of the year. Like they'll do like a couple months on, month off, couple months on, month off, or they'll do like 3 or 4 months in a row and then a couple months off. And that I've seen is kind of like I haven't really figured out exactly why it's used that way. My guess is that it's kind of like a memory consolidation strategy that they don't even know why they're doing it really, but it's just like it fits better into the routine of, okay, you've learned these skills and now, you know, go out on the road and let's see how you do with applying them. So that's kind of one strategy. In service, the in-service usage of E-Train uses an interesting feature of E-Train that I kind of mentioned briefly before, which is that it will adapt to your capabilities. So, you know, if you've got like in E-Train, we'll cover things like, you know, vehicle stops, kinesic interview training, use of force decisions, de-escalation techniques, you know, you name it, right? And so with each of these categories will come up in a given scenario, you know, there's no siloing, you know, because like life isn't siloed, right? You'll have in a vehicle stop, you'll have a constitutional issue come up. You'll have a de-escalation issue come up. You might have, you know, something else come up, an interview, kinesic interview issue come up. So as you do more and more scenarios, you accumulate scores by your accuracy, your response time in these various areas. And so you could have like, you know, you're 9 out of 10 on use of force, you're 2 out of 10 on vehicle stops, right? And so if that's the case, like 9 out of 10 use of force, 2 out of 10 vehicle stops, the next video at that moment, the next video, the next scenario you see would be automatically picked to give you like a really hard use of force, like try to get you a really hard use of force, but also get you an easier vehicle stop, right? Something that can push you from 2 to 3, 2 to 4, rather than like up to 9, because you're not ready for it and you're just going to miserably fail that, right? Now, you know, it's not that easy because sometimes, you know, you can't really pick life to fit. But for the most part, the algorithm that we have is pretty good at doing that. We've been deploying it for, I'd say the last 4 years of the 6 for the NHL officials, and it's worked swimmingly. I mean, it's really good. And what the great thing about it is that it gives the user, the officer, the official, the referee, the linesman, it gives the user the experience that they're like getting just practice, but it's targeted to their particular strengths and weaknesses. And it's so helpful in that regard, I think, because like, I mean, it's like having a a coach, a trainer with you all the time, to kind of guide you. And that's really on the in-service side. Now they'll review on the in-service side, they'll review what we call the after action report in E-Train, which shows like, okay, at this juncture, the question was this, and you answered of A, B, and C, you answered A, and that was right because this is what the law is in that situation. So there's a little more of a readout, like you would see in something like Police One, or like something you would see in Virtual Academy and other, you know, other e-learning products like that. So we do have some more of that like detailed explanation text type stuff, but you know, and it's not really a criticism of the industry. It's just like, I think the reality of the industry before, like when we arrived, was there's a lot of words. There's a lot of text in a lot of these products. And I know that that's the basis of the law is the text, right? And how that text is applied. But the actual policing act is its decision making on visual and auditory cues in the moment. It's not reading something and then, you know what I mean? Like you have to apply the text, you have to apply the policy, whether it's constitutional, state, whatever, in the moment. But the actual like neurophysiological mechanism that's going on, it's not you're reading a story about, you know, a guy coming at you with a gun. Like the guy is coming at you with a gun, right? And that's very different on a brain processing level, reading it versus reading about it, versus actually being there when the thing is coming at you. And, right. You know, that's one of the reasons why E-Train, you know, isn't perfect, right? As much as I would love for it to be so, it's just not. And as much as the New York Times behind me would say otherwise, you know, about other things we did, we're not perfect. So one of the reasons that it's good, but not perfect, is because body-worn camera footage is one of the ways that we simulate that experience of being in the encounter. Right. There are a lot of tools out there for reenactments, like virtual reality type things and stuff like that. But and even role-based training in academies and in agencies is a good alternative too. The problem with that is that you know that they're role playing, you know that they're acting, right? Because I mean, as a cop, I mean, I didn't really grow up with much law enforcement experience. I'll tell you about that later, but. But as a cop, I'm sure, Carrie, like you've got a great BS detector, right? Like you know when somebody like you know what I mean, like you know kind of where things are going. You kind of have this street smart level that tells you like when things are for real and when things are not. And so when you're training with reenacted scenarios or with role playing or any of these kind of things, like you know when that was all you could do, great. Right. But now with body worn camera footage, like you can do a lot better. And that's telling you the exact intensity of that really pissed off motorist who you just pulled over. Right. In terms of his speaking or her speaking, you know, manner, their clothing telling you all sorts of, I mean, all those things are relevant in terms of getting the hairs on the back of your neck to stand up or not stand up, in terms of how you make a decision. So in service training, the use of the body worn camera, I think, is very helpful for that because it gives them an analog to what it's like when they're on patrol, but it's not the same kind of consequences of a mistake, right? In terms of, you know, life preservation.
Right. Which makes total sense.
Right.
So let me ask you this, I'm always fascinated by how a referee, baseball, NHL, football, whatever, can see a split second play. And they've been watching it develop. They see the critical moment. They make their decision. Tennis, the ball's in or out. The tag was made at the first base. The first baseman caught the ball before the runner tagged the bag. How does DeServo take an umpire, a referee, and teach them how to make even better decisions? And most of them are pretty darn good at what they do.
Yeah.
I mean, for all the calls that they make, the vast majority don't get challenged. So how does DeServo or E-Train or whatever system you're using, how does that help them make faster, better decisions?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because, you know, the director of officiating for the NHL, Stephen Walcom, he was a veteran official, you know, officiated in the Stanley Cup playoffs many times, the finals many times. And he would always tell us, like, we don't want them making fast decisions, you know, so don't measure how quickly they make the decisions. So I tell them, it's like, don't worry, we're not pushing them to make them faster, because they actually don't want them to make the decisions quickly. I don't know if you ever watched in a NHL game or any hockey game, you could have, like, you know, some action happens, right? And then, like, a minute later, you'll get a whistle, right? So they'll do that sometimes in hockey, because they'll want to, like, mentally go through what they just saw sometimes, and they have a little more luxury to do that. NBA, they don't have that luxury. Baseball, for sure, Major League umpires do not have that luxury. We did work with the Major League umpires.
I was going to say, but at the same time, your first base umpire.
Yeah.
There's a delay, and even on the home plate, sometimes it feels to me anyway.
Right.
There's a delay. That runner crosses the bag. The ball's been caught by the first baseman. I'm like, oh, that was really close.
Right.
And there's this time period that passes.
Yeah. Where you're, like, with bated breath trying to see, right, what the ball's going to be, right?
Like, it's going to be.
Right. Right.
Out.
Right.
And there's that hesitation. I shouldn't say it's a hesitation purposely, but there's a time delay.
Yeah.
So are they being taught
what they saw? Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Replaying what they saw. To in their mind, to, like, make sure and, you know, kind of re-examine it. And that's something that's kind of interesting for us from the quick decision-making side. Like, we made our first product was something called U-Hit. It's for hitters, right? And it's for hitters recognizing pitches, curveball, slider, right? In 2018, one of the owners of the Mets at the time, his name is Fred Wilpon, had, you know, been in touch with us, and he said, I want to introduce you to the umpires at Major League Baseball, because I think they could benefit from this for calling balls and strikes. So, you know, one of the benefits of being in New York is that you're in New York. Like, a lot of things are in New York, right? So it's literally down the street. So we pitched this idea to Major League Baseball to train their umpires, basically modifying our baseball hitting training product for umpires, right? And it was a growing pains kind of year for us to, like, learn, what the analogs were and what the analogs weren't. We were kind of approaching it at the time, I'd say, more like scientists rather than like business owners. So we modified our baseball hitting product, U-Hit, to be this umpire training product for calling balls and strikes, which we called U-Call. And we started getting exposed to all sorts of things. They don't have to decide right away, right? They can wait, like, as you noticed, right? The pitch will come and there's a little bit of a delay. They were more interested in terms of timing. They weren't interested in calling quickly the balls or strikes. They were interested in balls being called at the same timing after the pitch is past the plate as strikes. Because the batters or the catchers would start to notice, you know, if there's a longer delay, it's going to be a ball. If it's a shorter time frame, it's going to be, you know what I mean? So they were more interested in, like, how quickly after the ball crossed the plate are your balls and strikes? What's the difference between your times for balls and strikes? And they do all sorts of things that, you know, were just, like, not what we expected. So Major League, I'm still in touch with a lot of the Major League Baseball umpires. Fortunately, you know, they're actually interested in doing something again with us. So we'll see what happens with that. Because everybody loves to hate on the umpires. So, you know, they're always looking for a way to do things better.
100%.
At the same time, though, the NHL we started working with the NHL, and that was only because the NBA balked at it. They balked at the idea of working with us after the former commissioner of the NBA, David Stern, pitched us to them. And we met David Stern at a he also went to Columbia University, and he went to law school there. And he was a great guy. It was such a shame when he passed away. He died about a month before all the COVID lockdown stuff started. I always referred to him like as our rabbi of sports marketing. Like, he just knew everything. And it was like, my father was a rabbi, so I know the experience. Like, you go to the office, you sit at the feet of the master, and you hear the wisdom, you know, and you just come out of there like knowing that you know a lot less of really what you thought you knew, but knowing there are so many more questions that you should be asking right now, right? That's what it was like going to David Stern's office. And he ran a panel for Columbia for this like sport tech entrepreneurship type thing in 2015. There's some videos of it online, and I think connected to our website. And they threw me up there because my partner Jordan and I had started DeServo out of Columbia Research. And so that's how I met David Stern. And he said, you know, on the panel, he said something like, you know, forget about the players. What about the referees? Because at the time we were just doing players. We were doing baseball players. You know, the Wall Street Journal thing you mentioned, New York Times, that was around that time, you know, that was highlighting all the baseball work. You're scanning the brains of baseball hitters and stuff. But we hadn't done anything with umpires, with referees. And before Fred Wilpon with the Major League Baseball umpires, it was David who said, you know, forget about the players. What about the referees? So he helped us kind of pitch the NBA, and, you know, that kind of dragged on about a year or so. And then since David's gone, I can say this. He said at the end of it, the NBA balked at it, right? So at the end of that, he said, we're in his office. We're at the feet of the master, right? And he says, fuck the NBA. I'm going to call Gary, my friend down the street. Who's Gary? Gary down the street, meaning down Fifth Avenue, is Gary Bettman. He's the commissioner of the NHL. Gary used to work for David as a lawyer at the NBA. So I'm going to call Gary. Calls Gary. Maybe like a week or so later, I'm down in spring training. We have a phone conference with the director of officiating, Steven, who I mentioned earlier. A hilarious guy named Colin Campbell. Coley is what they call him. And he's the executive chairman or something like that, executive vice president, something like that. And we're on the phone together after we've pitched to Gary and after we've met Steven a little bit. And we're getting into more of the weeds and stuff like that. And Coley says, I just want fewer shitty calls. That's all he says. I just want fewer shitty calls. And so, you know, we're like, well, we know some neuroscience stuff. We've made an app for hitters. Maybe we could do that for your officials, right? And so, you know, so fast forward 6 years, 7 years, we're in our seventh season now with them and with the minor leagues of hockey, who kind of, you know, they have floating officials who float back and forth between the East Coast Hockey League, the ECHL, and the American Hockey League, the AHL. But that's really kind of the process for how, you know, we got into those types of arbiter decisions. And, you know, there's so many other considerations with hockey that you don't have with baseball. Like, you have to be a great skater, right? That's like one of their primary recruitment tools, is to look at who can skate well, right? So you have a lot of former players. But, you know, in terms of how they see the game, that's the thing that we do with them, right? And so the question of, like, you know, seeing a bang bang play at first base, right? The ball hits the glove, the guy's foot hits the bag, which one happened before. You know, the equivalents in hockey, you know, fast breaks, you know, cross checking, boarding. I mean, it always looks like these guys are slugging each other. You know, they call it differently at the ECHL than they'll call it at the NHL, right? So sometimes leagues will call things differently. And NHL has what they call the standard of play calling. It's what Steven calls the standard of play calling, meaning like cross checkings are going to be called this way. Boardings are going to be called this way. Trippings are going to be called this way. And they want them to learn that standard of play calling, right? So it's like the law, right? It's like, this is going to be our policy for this, you know, municipality or this county, right? And yes, there are some general rules like the Constitution, right? But there are some general rules in hockey, like, you know, scoring goals and things like that, or, you know, not killing the opponent. And so, you know, how you adjudicate those things, right, are kind of the details, right? And how you learn to see the body language that is most relevant to the NHL standard, to El Cerrito, California's municipal police department, to Orange Beach, Alabama's municipal police department rules, right? Those are the specifics that then we're doing using video, using this layered approach of like, how are you deciding? Where are you deciding? What are you tapping on? What are you seeing? And how do we then get you to see those things better?
Wow, wow, wow. So much. So much, man.
That was a long answer to that question. I'm sorry.
No, that's it's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating how you guys have taken this concept of how we make decisions, slow and fast, and put it into a program, a software that teaches people how to make better decisions faster. Because that's critical. It doesn't matter whether you're a baseball player hitting a ball or a referee making a call. The analogies to law enforcement, how do you apply a set of standards to a particular situation so you make the right decision? Because what's happening now in law enforcement especially, and this goes whether we saw it with a paramedic, get two paramedics get prosecuted and sent to prison because they made a decision about how much ketamine to give to someone.
Wow.
And that patient died.
Wow.
And the guy, what's crazy about that case is the guy who didn't even administer the medicine, but he was the ranking officer, ranking paramedic on scene. He went to prison for 15 years.
Jesus.
The guy who actually pushed the syringe got sentenced to 5 years. Now, 5 years is still a long time, but it's not 15.
Wow.
These are paramedics.
Wow.
We just had a doctor and a nurse in San Diego County because of an inmate that died in custody in San Diego County Jail. Doctor and a nurse, both prosecuted.
Wow.
Because of the decisions that they made based on the information that they had about this patient's condition. We know that cops are getting prosecuted. And so as we look at how we're making decisions out in the field, the fact that DeServo is serving all these different communities and helping people make better decisions, pretty darn cool. Folks, if you want to learn more about DeServo, DeCervo, you can go to one of two places. You can go to the IDEA website, /DeServo, and we'll direct you over to their website. And you can also learn a little bit more about Jason. You can find out about Jason's bio and find out all sorts of information about DeServo, connect directly with them. So come to theidea.world/DeServo. And at the same time, while you're there, check out our other podcast episodes. Jason, thanks for being on the De-Escalation Conversations podcast. It has been a true pleasure to have you. I'd love to have you back and talk more about how these decision-making parameters work. Would you be open to that?
Sure, absolutely.
Very cool. Thanks for being here today. For our listeners, you know that you can go to theidea.world for all sorts of free resources. on advanced de-escalation, conflict resolution, and communication skills. Check us out. Check out the other episodes of our podcast at theidea.world/podcast. Definitely check out DeServo@DeServo, DeCervo. Until next time, please stay safe. You found a lot of great value in this episode of the De-escalation Conversations podcast. Please be sure to go out to our website, theidea.world, theidea.world. On that website, just click on the link that resonates with you most. If you're a K-12 educator, if you're a firefighter, medical services, law enforcement, flight attendants, whatever industry you're in, we have specialized training for you. So check that training out, because literally it can save your life, it can save your relationship, it can save your career. So check out theidea.world. I look forward to seeing you soon. Take care. This is Carrie Mintz here, and thanks for watching this episode of the De-escalation Conversations podcast. I hope you got some great insights that you can use right away. But don't stop here. Click that video link above and keep the momentum going with another powerful episode. And hey, if you haven't already, please hit that like button and the subscribe bell so you never miss an episode. New strategies, new stories, and new ways to connect coming your way every week. See you in the next episode.